Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, March 3rd, 2026, we are delighted to host this Courthouse Steps oral argument program on United States v. Hamani, which was argued yesterday before the court. My name is Matthew Sautel, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion on today's call are those of the experts, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, we'll keep the introductions brief, but if you'd like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we're fortunate to have Professor F. Lee Francis and Mr. Mark Levin as our speakers, and Mr. John Ohlendorf as our moderator. Mr. Ohlendorf is partner at Cooper & Kirk, PLLC. One last note throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature in Zoom so that we'll have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask that the questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. With that, thank you for being with us today. John, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Matthew, and thank you to the Federalist Society for inviting me to moderate this this discussion of what I think was a really interesting oral argument yesterday. The case is United States versus Hamani, which is a challenge to 18 U.S.C. Section 922G3, which is a federal statute that bars anyone who, quote, is an unlawful user of any controlled substance from keeping or carrying firearms. The respondent, Mr. Hamani, was convicted under Section 922G3 for possessing a handgun while being a regular user of marijuana. The United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit held the law unconstitutional, and the Supreme Court granted review. Here to break down the argument for us, we're fortunate to have two excellent experts. Professor F. Lee Francis is an assistant professor at Widener University Commonwealth Law School. Professor Francis previously served as a federal prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of North Carolina and as an Army JAG officer. Also with us is Mark Levin, who is Chief Policy Counsel for the Council on Criminal Justice. Mr. Levin is a leading writer and thinker on criminal justice reform, who has testified multiple times before Congress and several state legislatures. So I'd like to just dive into the case, and I think my impression, and you know, I'm interested to hear y'all's impression before the argument, was that the court had probably taken this case to reverse and uphold Section 922G3, at least as applied here. I'll start with you, Mark. Was that your sense, or did you have a different take?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's reasons to think that. Obviously, the oral argument ended up, I think, going quite differently. My sense was, you know, there may be as many as 7 votes to, at least on narrow grounds, as applied to Mr. Hamani, say that the statute can't be constitutionally applied, obviously dealing with both the intersection of Second Amendment and vagueness concerns. And I mean, one of the things I just, you know, because I work primarily in the public policy arena now, that I think is really interesting to people, kind of isn't the legal issue per se, certainly, but the fact that, you know, there's not a whole lot of evidence that this statute, which carries up to 10 years in prison, makes a meaningful difference in reducing now this provision of it. Now, the provision, which isn't an issue in this case, dealing with felon in possession, that is a whole other, and that's, you know, that can make up a third of cases in Cook County, felony cases, and getting guns away from, in many cases, gang members, does have substantial impact on crime, but this part dealing with somebody who either uses drugs or is an addict, and this one dealt with the user part of it. That one is, there's really little evidence that it makes a dent in crime. There just aren't that many cases, number one. And obviously there's a certain common logic to it that certainly being under the influence of dangerous drugs while you have a gun, which wasn't, again, what was at issue here. But that's number one, is like that this probably has relatively little measurable impact on gun violence. But number two is, I always think it's interesting to talk about the facts. And the fact is that this raid was based on, this actually ironically enough, given what's going on now, an Iranian individual, but the raid was based on national security and fraud concerns, really kind of FBI big, you know, allegations, but ultimately those never panned out. And so this was the only thing they could get him on, was having a little bit of marijuana at the same time he owned a gun. And I think that's one of the problems, obviously not with the necessarily the constitutional issue, but the fact that this statute really does allow people, the government, after they find nothing else on someone after raiding their home, to put them in prison for up to 10 years or something that has no public safety import, at least in this context.
Lee, let me get you in. Did you have a similar take to mine coming into the argument, and did you have a similar take to Mark's coming out of the argument?
You know, I think I did. I mean, if you'd asked me before the oral argument took place, I would have told you this would look something like Rahimi, where you have an 8-1 majority. And Justice Thomas writing for himself in dissent. And gosh, did at least, you know, the oral argument seem like, you know, that would not be the case. I think Mark is right that maybe, you know, it would be a 7-2 in favor of affirming. But that's certainly not the idea or the impression I had going into oral argument.
So Lee has mentioned a 7-2 in favor of Mr. Hamani. Mark mentioned, I think, an 8-1. I think I know who at least the one is, at least I'm guessing. And I'm guessing it's Justice Alito, who has, you know, I think traditionally been seen as a real friend to Second Amendment rights, wrote the plurality in McDonald, was in the majority in Bruin. Why do you think he may be kind of sizing this one up a little differently? Have Lee take a stab at it first.
So, you know, I think it's a good question. I think with Justice Alito, at least the impression from the oral argument is that I do think that he believes Congress has already done majority of the work, that the, and I think this is also where Justice Roberts, you know, the Chief Justice, comes in, where, you know, what's the court's role once Congress has passed the statute, identified this particular, you know, this conduct using drugs, being addicted to drugs, as dangerous or unlawful, that Justice Alito seems to think, well, I don't know that there's a lot that the court can do here. And the government's analogies focuses more on the habitual drunkard laws that did exist. Certainly there are some, you know, a number of issues with those as analogies under the Bruin standard. But I think, you know, Justice Alito seems to think that the work has already been done, and finding an individualized determination of dangerous would certainly not be a workable or practical framework. And the idea that it's not just categories of drugs where, you know, it's individuals, it's what type of drugs. I mean, it seems like this would really use a lot of resources just to make these determinations. Respondent argues, well, but that's already being done. You know, the juries are already making these determinations under the statute, you know, itself. But I think Justice Alito seems to think that, he even says, you know, I don't even understand what you're arguing for. And, you know, in response to respondent's point. But I think Justice Alito believes the work has already been done.
Well, except that, I mean, I was very much persuaded by Justice Gorsuch and Justice Barrett's arguments that no, it hasn't. That, in fact, the Controlled Substances Act considers a whole many a panoply of factors, most having nothing to do with whether using any amount of the drug could make you more prone to violence. And so it really hasn't been done. And of course, I thought the attorneys for Hamani were very effective in saying, we're not arguing you can't have a categorical approach, but that Congress could identify certain drugs that do of any use of, or certainly being a habitual user, even if not an addict, would make you so prone to violence that lines up with the kind of public drunkard analogy at the time of the founding, where somebody drank so much that they were, you know, a vagabond on the street and they had to be civilly committed. They had to have a guardian appointed. You know, and one of the interesting things I don't know that they really explored as much as I would find interesting is this. It was referenced that was at the time of the founding would be a justice of the peace. The justice of the peace knew the person. I mean, the country didn't even have that many people at the time. And now what we're talking about is basically being railroaded through the federal system, which is a plea machine. Everybody pleas, and you've got mandatory minimums and up to 10 years in prison. So I think when you look at the context of it, and of course, there already is a fact inquiry. You have to have a factual, individualized inquiry to determine if somebody's addicted. So what we're talking about is the other part of it. And I thought that they made a good argument that, yeah, we don't think it's would work for marijuana, but Congress could categorically say certain drugs are so dangerous that they would, in any use, would warrant this, and that it could be consistent with this Bruin standard, that it needs to line up with the habitual drunkard laws at the time of the founding.
Yeah, let me push on that a little bit. I think it was Justice Barrett who brought up the Ambien example, right? Mm-hmm. A spouse who uses unlawfully her husband's prescription Ambien. Is the fact that Ambien is on the schedule a determination by Congress that someone who's using it in this way is dangerous? And I think that's compelling. But on kind of the flip side, I wonder, what do you think, Mark, is there room for some sort of deference or respect by the courts for legislative determination of dangerousness? And I'm thinking in particular of some of the other categories in 922, right? So the fugitives from justice came up at the argument, or you can think of someone who's a convicted serial killer. Is there a role for deference to maybe Congress's determinations that those categories of people are dangerous to be armed, or do we always need an individualized determination?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And then there's not so much gray area as to whether you're a fugitive or whether you're a serial killer or whether you have a felony conviction and now you have a gun. But when you talk about, how much of a drug, what potency of the drug, it gets a lot more sketchy. So I do think they can distinguish, and I think they will, because obviously the court doesn't want to call into question the other parts of the statute. I thought the Ambien thing was a great point. I mean, and it could operate in the context of, as she said, a spouse where you're using your spouse's Ambien, she or he has a prescription, but you don't, or two students living in a dorm and all of that. And technically it's illegal. It's on and Adderall was another one, because that's even on the second schedule two that was mentioned. And so the government, I thought that they had trouble saying, is it just that it's illegal, or does it have to be on one schedule or the other? And when it boils down to is Congress didn't really have this in mind when they designed the schedule and the Controlled Substance Act. And it's just trying to fit a square peg into a round hole.
I think one of the things that Aaron Murphy, the attorney for Hamani, floated at the argument in response to some pushback she was getting from the Chief Justice and Justice Alito about the practicability of having an individualized determination in every case, was this idea of, well, maybe we have an individualized determination for different types of drugs. Rather than specific drug users. Lee, do you think that is a practicable approach, or is that not any better than just having a determination in every case?
My preference would be, I think when we're dealing with really trying to figure out where Bruin fits, would be to say that we would need an individualized determination in each case. I mean, I think this was Justice Jackson's concern was, you know, what really is the standard we're applying here? And if we're just, you know, allowing Congress to make some modern revelation that now this drug has, you know, is dangerous or is illegal, well, that seems to be the opposite of what the Bruin standard requires. And I certainly understand the practicality aspect, where it's, are we really going to have juries make this decision in every case? But Ms. Murphy says, well, but this already happened, so it's not like we're wasting resources or expending resources we don't necessarily have. I guess I understand the concession that certain categories could be. Drug categories could be categorically excluded. I would probably push back on that and say, well, you know, it's not like these drugs were you know, just invented in the last 20 years. I mean, opium has existed for centuries. It was used, during the Civil War. I mean, we have a long history of not just alcoholism, but of drug use. And Congress could have legislated against those things that, you know, either, you know, close in time to the Civil War or even before the founding era. And yet they chose not to. And so I would argue that even having wide categories of drugs, specific types of drugs, could still fail under the Bruin standard.
Another move that that Aaron made in response to kind of these practical concerns, and I think Lee, you adverted to it, was to kind of try to say that, well, juries or courts are already kind of making an individualized dangerous determination in the context of determining, at least for the addict prong of G3, right, whether the defendant is an addict of the substance. I guess I'm wondering, is that really right? Does a determination that someone is, say, addicted to marijuana really involve also a determination of dangerousness? Or is the point that, you know, well, it's not really much of a heavier lift to also task them with determining dangerousness?
Yeah, I do think there can be a distinction, because obviously you can be addicted to caffeine or something and it doesn't make you dangerous. It's a compulsion to have something, but it's not necessarily something that's social media, which maybe it can make you dangerous depending on what you're consuming there. But, you know, so I do think there's a bit of a difference there. But I mean, Alito seems so worried about juries having to sort through this. I mean, there's not a huge volume of cases, and it is kind of the thing that juries do. And I mean, I also think that juries, yes, there's the jury instructions and all that, but I mean, if that's the only thing somebody did and there's no public safety linkage, I think most prosecutors wouldn't bring it, and a lot of juries may be tempted to nullify, you know, rightly or wrongly. So I think juries expect to. And of course, there was the reference to the definition of addiction or habitual user in the Controlled Substances Act, which references public morals. And Aaron was kind of making the point that maybe that they really mean is public safety. And that's, you know, it could be through, as she said, a compulsion to use, or it could just be that you do truly voluntarily without that compulsion, just enjoy it so much, you use it to excess. And you, as the public drunkards did back in the day, you're lying on the street, you're making a scene, you're unable to take care of yourself, you're a danger to yourself or others, the kind of thing that would get you committed or have a guardianship appointed. So one way or the other, whether through a compulsion or through, you know, a truly voluntary decision to overconsume a certain drug or alcohol. So, and I really think that's, in this case, doesn't, you know, the facts involving this case really don't fit into either of those. And so it really did seem like the government, after they struck out on the serious charges, they just tried to this was the only thing he was actually convicted of. And it just seems like, I guess they say bad cases make bad law. Is that it? But maybe your bad cases may make good law from my perspective in this case, as it turns out.
Lee, you mentioned Justice Jackson's questioning during the argument, and it also seemed to me that she expressed some skepticism with the government's arguments. Do you think that is genuine, or you know, I took kind of the thrust of her questions and her opinion in Rahimi to be an attempt to use what seemed like a pretty difficult case to call the Bruin framework itself into question. Do you think that's what she's up to here? Or do you think she genuinely may be inclined in favor of voting for the petitioner here? For Mr. Hamani?
I think it's possible that she's inclined to vote for Hamani. I think you're right in the idea that she just doesn't like the Bruin standard. And it's not a, you know, it's not that she doesn't have warm and fuzzies about it, but it's more of the sense that she doesn't understand how to use it. And I think courts are struggling with this, you know, all around the country. And I think for her, I think Justice Sotomayor would say the same thing is, you know, at least what the government sounds like to them seems like they're just using ends means, which Bruin said, well, we don't do this anymore. And so I think Justice Jackson and Justice Sotomayor's point is, well, this just sounds like ends means scrutiny. And, you know, if you're saying something's illegal and Congress has made that determination and that's the end of it. But I thought we were looking at historical analogs. Mm-hmm. And that's not, you haven't identified one that's, You know, Hamani says, you know, he uses it, you know, a couple times a week or every other week. We're not talking about people falling over drunk. I mean, Aaron says, well, you know, it's someone who, if they're addicted, they are unable to function. They're unable to have a normal life. There's no evidence that is what's happening with Hamani. So if you're not using the Bruin test and you're using ends means, this could be an effort, certainly if she's writing a majority opinion, which I don't expect, but if she is, you know, she could say the Bruin test isn't working. Maybe that gives her an opportunity to kind of reshape what the standard would be. I don't see that happening, but I do think that's part of the thought process is, yes, we know the facts are not good, you know, for the government here. But maybe this is our opportunity to alter the Bruin standard.
With Justice Jackson seeing that potential opportunity and with the skepticism that Justice Alito seemed to express, Lee, do you think we still have a majority of justices committed to the Bruin framework?
I certainly think if we're counting, I mean, I think Justice Gorsuch, Justice Barrett, obviously, certainly Justice Thomas would still support it. I think, you know, again, we're considering that, you know, the Chief Justice and Justice Alito were in the majority in Bruin. So it is difficult for me to kind of think about, you know, if we're dealing with, say, for example, a felon in possession case. Now, of course, the court has turned that down. Where would they be in the, you know, whether they would uphold the Bruin standard? Gosh, you know, I could at least get to three. Is it possible I get to five? You know, maybe we have Justice Kavanaugh there. And I could see in the right case, I could probably see Justice Alito coming back in the event that we're dealing with a non-dangerous kind of scenario. This is the food stamp fraud. This is a writing the bad check, you know, scenario. I could see the majority supporting the Bruin standard in that instance, because we're not talking about dangerousness. We're just talking about now, is this, you know, food stamp fraud analogous to any law that would have permanently, you know, taken away someone's right to bear arms?
Mark, did you get a sense for where Justice Kavanaugh might be on this one?
Yeah, it seemed like he was going in the direction towards the end of oral argument towards a narrow, you know, ruling in favor of Hamani, and perhaps emphasizing that Congress could still categorically decide certain drugs are so dangerous that even short of being an addict, that you know that could be prohibited categorically. And of course, you know, there's no controversy. Even Hamani, everybody concedes, like, if you possess the gun while you're using the drugs, I mean, that's like a heartland of this that isn't even in question. I like to think about, like, I don't know if there's an analogy here, but I mean, what if a law said that, you know, you lose your right to vote if you're an addict because you're not capable of making a good decision? You might not even know that the box you're checking, if you're completely zoned out, the box you're checking is the candidate you actually meant to vote for. I mean, people, if you think about, obviously, justices on the left side of the court, they would probably be completely against something like that. Seem to me like, I don't see how you can have the Bruin standard in certain cases like the ones you were talking about, Lee, and then not apply that here and find that this just doesn't line up with the kind of the public drunkenness analogy at the time of the founding. So I think the judges, to some degree, certainly Sotomayor, she seemed enjoying the idea of making, you know, somebody like Alito and Roberts face the consequences of Bruin in this context.
I thought that as well. I'd like to spend a little bit of time on kind of the historical analogies relied on by the government. And let me stick with you for first, Mark. In its briefing, anyway, the government had kind of three categories. It had vagrancy laws. It had kind of civil commitment laws that I think, you know, allowed a justice of the peace to maybe appoint a guardian for someone who is a habitual drunkard, or to send them to a workhouse. And then they had the surety laws that were relied on in Rahimi. I thought that Justice Kagan drew an interesting distinction sort of in the first half of the argument between laws aimed at public safety and laws aimed at public order, with really kind of the vagrancy laws falling more into that latter bucket, where it's not so much a risk of violence that we're concerned about, it's just public disorderliness. Do you think that's a distinction that's reflected in the history? And if so, do you think, you know, what do you think the implications are for the Bruin framework? Can we rely on kind of the public order type laws to disarm someone today who just poses a threat to of public disorder?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think it's one that this outcome of this case won't hinge on it, because obviously he just had, you know, marijuana in his home and we wasn't laying on the street or causing, there's no evidence or allegation that, you know, he was disruptive in his life to other people, let alone was a vagrant or something like that. But I think, in Texas we have open carry, and that's true in some other states as well. And so, some people certainly would think about, okay, am I comfortable just, you know, walking by a person who's brandishing a gun, or at least holding a gun, and also maybe looks unstable or is homeless or something like that. And, these are, concerns that are bound to come up. Of course, legislatures can address it by saying, here's the criteria you need to meet if you want to have a permit system, as opposed to just saying, as we do in Texas, you can open carry without a permit now. But, you know, we really haven't seen, there was kind of a, you know, parade of horribles and things that stem from it, and haven't really seen that materialize. And indeed, of course, the last few years, gun ownership's been going up dramatically in the U.S. And of course, a number of people, for example, in the minority, African-Americans bought guns after George Floyd was killed. Some said it was to protect themselves from police, for example. But at the same time, homicides are going through the floor. We've documented this at the council. So we have this big increase in gun ownership, and at the same time, homicides going down. And by the way, the same thing's happened in Canada. Gun ownership's been going up there, including 2024 and 25, and they've also had a 20% roughly reduction in homicides. So, you know, I don't want to say it's a solution in search of a problem, because gun violence is an enormous problem still in the United States, particularly concentrated in certain areas. But this, the particular fact pattern here certainly doesn't suggest that that Hamani was any part of that. And that, you know, I think that the red flag laws typically focus on a very urgent danger to public safety and a pretty high bar, agree with them or not. And I think once you get outside of that, you also run into, you know, opposition, including from many, many, many folks on the center right as well. So there's also the political component. But I really think that maybe we're, there's other areas that would be more fruitful to focus on when it comes to reducing gun violence, like solving more homicides.
One of the moves that the court made in the Rahimi decision was to say that, well, there were various historical legal regimes that allowed for imprisonment of people who posed a risk of dangerous or a risk of, for example, spouse abuse. And so that kind of justifies the greater includes of the lesser, right? The fact that you could imprison these people at the founding means you can disarm them temporarily today. The government relies on that same type of reasoning in its brief here. Do you think, Lee, that that argument works here just as well, or you know, is there something in Rahimi that that was missing here?
Well, I think Justice Thomas's dissent in Rahimi really attacks what the majority's position was, at least in that case, you know, certainly with the surety laws and the going armed laws, you know, that didn't deny someone, you know, the right to have a firearm. It just means that they paid a bond and they, you know, paid their fine and promised not to, you know, do anything bad. You know, they didn't, you know, lose their rights. But I think the big distinction in Rahimi is the fact that it was, you know, Rahimi as a defendant was just cartoonishly violent. I mean, you know, it's like a Tarantino movie. He's shooting people on the streets, and he's, you know, he's got this issue with his girl. So there was no question about his violence or his dangerousness. And so I don't know that the, you know, reliance on even, you know, the commitment laws and the vagrancy laws and the surety laws that the government seems to rely on here in Hamani really captures the facts of this case. And I think that's why they're, you know, they struggled quite a lot with the questioning, is that it's not the same thing. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, talk about vagrancy laws when someone's out in public. But if you're home, what's the danger? What's the, you know, what's the problem? You know, he's not falling down in the street. And so I don't know that the government really could faithfully rely on Rahimi, because I just don't think it's the same type of case.
Mark, another category of historical laws that the government relied on in the briefing were laws disarming, for example, British loyalists during the course of the American Revolution, people who had engaged in rebellion, for example, the Shays rebels or the Whiskey rebels in the early Republic. Do you think that those are analogies that the court is going to have any interest in here?
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. Obviously, they're kind of national security oriented, we're in a time. I mean, I think the and of course, it presumably involves some individualized determination, I guess, to determine if somebody's just as you would to determine if they're an addict or if they're dangerous or, you know, at risk of committing a crime with a weapon because of their addiction or frequent use of a certain drug. So, yeah, I don't know that it gets the government. I don't think it gets the government where they need to be. But yeah, I kind of empathize to some degree with their case, with their situation, because it is really difficult to meet the standard that was set in Bruin. But I think that it was designed that way.
Lee, another argument that that the government made, I think both in its briefing and at the end of the oral argument yesterday, was that to the extent there are concerns about how 922G3 applies in a kind of an edge case, as I think you both are describing this one, right? A case where you have someone who, you know, as far as the government was able to prove, is just someone who's kind of occasionally using marijuana in his home, right? So assuming that this is an edge case, the government says, okay, well, yes, there may be edge cases, but we have this kind of newly reinvigorated rights restoration process that the Justice Department has recently kind of polished off, right? Does the availability of rights restoration through a process, you know, under the kind of the Attorney General or her designees, does that allay any Second Amendment concerns here?
I don't think so. I mean, because my initial thought is, well, the right is being removed. So they're losing the right. So to say that you could have it subsequently restored 5 or 10 years down the line or whatever the process would be, doesn't change the fact that we don't really have a good analogous law that Bruin requires. So my thought is the initial intrusion, the prohibition is really wrong at the start. So if you could remedy it later, you'll get this back. I don't know that you know resolves the initial problem of the dispossession where there's no historical basis.
Mark, do you agree with that, or do you think the rights restoration process can kind of ride to the government's rescue here?
No, I'm afraid not. I mean, now of course that. I think, as I understand it, deals primarily with the case where somebody has a felony. I mean, there was a case that came up in the course of when I worked on the First Step Act. There was, when it came out of the House, there was a provision that would have actually reined in the career criminal the gun possession, the stacking of the mandatory minimums on the portion of 922 dealing with the felon in possession. But you would have cases like a turkey farmer in Tennessee who had a drug possession felony when he was 20 years old, and here he is. He's 60 years old and he's got a rifle hunting turkey and he's got it. And, you know, he gets arrested and it's just, this isn't who the statute was intended to capture. But unfortunately that part got omitted from the First Step Act that as it was signed, because it didn't have enough votes in the Senate. But, you know, I really think that needs to be, reined in those mandatory minimums. But it's good to, of course, have a situation where somebody could be granted relief when it was a felony committed so many years ago that has no relationship to who they are today based on, many years of, you know, living crime free and so forth, and proving that they're a good risk to regain their Second Amendment rights. But certainly that doesn't justify removing it and their rights to begin with in violation of this. Now it does, you know, one of the questions that does come up here is, you know, when would you have had to last using? I mean, some people might have drugs stowed in their house that they haven't used in, you know, weeks or months. And now they would probably be able to prevail on that basis. But, you know, just when the police show up and find the drugs, they're still going to get arrested and maybe even charged. So it's kind of like, well, when did you stop using drugs? And then now it's your burden to prove that. So, I think that the court is just going to say, look, you've got to you've got to have some indicia of dangerousness that would somehow match up to what, you know, we saw with public drunkards and something at the time of the founding. And or Congress could categorically say that certain drugs are so dangerous in any amount and no person could safely use any amount that we're going to say those qualify regardless of how frequently somebody uses them.
In Hamani's opening brief before the Supreme Court, he really seemed to shift the focus of the case to something we haven't talked about yet this afternoon, which is his vagueness challenge. The idea that the way that Congress, you know, defines or doesn't define unlawful user, doesn't satisfy due process by giving fair notice to people of when they might fall within the statutory confines. That was not something that Erin Murphy emphasized at argument at all. I think she was asked about it at some point and then of course said, yes, obviously we believe in our vagueness argument. But Lee, why do you think that is? Why do you think that she seems to have made the decision in the argument to kind of shift back towards the Second Amendment rather than vagueness?
You know, it's a good question. So Justice Sotomayor is the one who says, to Erin, we haven't heard you make your vagueness argument. And of course, the response is, well, we obviously covered it, extensively in our brief. The notice problems, I think, kind of seem to be obvious. I mean, I think Justice Kavanaugh was pointing this out with the what does public morals mean, to the detriment of public morals? What does that mean? And so the idea here is, well, what's an unlawful user? I think one of the things that they've been able to do, or at least they did in the oral argument, was tie it back to the CSA. And there's at one point, there's a colloquy with the Respondents Council, which says, this definition of an addict, we'll agree to that. That makes sense. That's historically based, as with Justice Kavanaugh. And I think the question becomes, are we dealing with conduct-based or status-based problems. So if we're saying, well, your status as an unlawful user, well, certainly you need to know what that means. And is it someone who used 2 weeks prior or, hasn't used in a month? What does that mean? Or are we really dealing with the conduct being defined as dangerous? Are we conduct based? And I think I certainly think the vagueness issue is there. I think at least the way that I understood the respondent's argument was that I don't know how far you need to go down that hole if the government can't provide a proper analog. So certainly the vagueness is there, but if you don't have any historical statute to justify the modern regulation, I don't know that you need to spend a lot of time on vagueness.
One of the interesting things was mens rea.
That's right.
Came up in this context of vagueness. And of course, the government said the only mens rea is needed is to know, you have drugs or something. And I mean, of course, obviously it's true ignorance of the law. The truism is not an excuse. It's just, but it is kind of troubling. Like the vast majority of Americans and the vast majority of gun owners probably don't know about this statute. Obviously the Hunter Biden case. Now he was also charged with making a false statement, and that was the on his application to buy a gun. And that was the one he pled to, not this provision of being a user or addict, but he was charged with it. So, I mean, that probably raised public consciousness a little bit about this, but the case got covered more from the standpoint of the false statement on the application where he said he doesn't use drugs. It is kind of, but the drugs, is it okay that they're in your house and you're at a party having? And I mean, it's like so divorced from the doing something dangerous with a gun that it's like the average person just wouldn't think about that they have the exposure to this. Maybe that's not good enough to have a constitutional violation, but it does seem somewhat relevant to the fair notice aspect of vagueness.
Yeah, and I think Justice Gorsuch may have been the one who brought up the Rehab case where we've got to deal with they knowingly possess a firearm, that's fine, but did they know that they were a part of a prohibited category while they did it? You've got 40 states now, if not more, who've legalized marijuana in some form, whether that's medical or recreational. So it's reasonable to think, at least it's kind of dirty. It's not clear in the sense that, cocaine, sure, that's clearly people know that is illegal. But maybe that's not a straightforward question when you're dealing with marijuana, when you are in a state, Justice Gorsuch says, Colorado, it's legal, whether you have a prescription or not. But then the federal government says, yeah, so it's also legal. But did the defendant know that they were part of that, you know, category where they were prohibited? And I think if that category is unclear, then proving knowledge is quite difficult to do.
This is kind of a jump ball for either one of you, but what are the implications for this case of the fact that, you know, the administration appears to be very seriously considering rescheduling marijuana down from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3?
Well, I think the government's position was, if it's on the schedule, we'll take that as you could still be charged under the statute. So it wouldn't necessarily matter if it's a Schedule 3 or a Schedule 1 or a Schedule 5. It's possible you are you could be an unlawful user in the sense that this isn't your prescription, or you're addicted to something I guess I don't know from the government's perspective that the schedule changes, you know, really does anything.
Yeah, the Solicitor General, or I don't remember the name, or deputy who was arguing it, she said that was their frontline position, but their secondary position was, if you want, kind of inviting the court to choose which schedules you want to say are okay. But, you know, that, and then that's where the obviously marijuana changing schedules kind of throws a wrench into things. But I didn't sense any interest on the part of the court in taking that invitation to make a distinction between, you know, levels of the schedule. And I think it goes back to the fact that just this wasn't this, you know, risk of violence. It was not the primary or even even a main element of determining which drugs are in which schedules to begin with. So how do you draw a line then between schedules?
As we sort of wind down before turning to a handful of questions from the audience we have, I'm going to ask both of you to kind of call the shot in a minute here. But first, it seemed to me that at several points in the argument, Justice Gorsuch and maybe also Justice Kavanaugh were kind of looking for a narrow way to decide this case, you know, I think in favor of Mr. Hamani, but in a way that would do as little violence as possible to the rest of Section 922. Starting with you, Lee, do you think there is kind of a narrow ground like that available to the court here? And if so, what would it be?
I think there is a narrow ground. I think if I'm looking for an easy way to dispose of this case, I would rest on whether the conduct was dangerous. And by doing so, you know, the we're dealing with as applied. There could be a scenario where someone is, you know, so addicted to something, say meth, for example, methamphetamine or cocaine or whatever the drug may be, that we could now have a challenge where there, you know, certain their conduct has become dangerous, or they're unable to function in everyday life as the statute says. So if I'm looking for an easy way out, the middle ground would be everyone believes that dangerous people shouldn't have firearms. This is not a case where we're dealing with a particularly dangerous individual. So as it applies to Mr. Hamani, that, you know, we would affirm that decision.
Yeah, to say at least for marijuana, right, they may not preclude other drugs, saying for marijuana, given it perhaps also the kind of the way in which, as you said, the fair notice interacts with the fact that it's legal in so many places and so widely consumed, that we're not we're basically going to say that you still have the addicted prong, which is separate, but at least is this user prong that you have to do more than show that somebody's used marijuana. It's compromised their capacity to own a firearm, and it's got to be, to me, that does, you know, entail some type of jury instruction about that. And I imagine they would let lower courts determine. I don't know what the procedures are. Mr. Hamani could be retried on that basis. It appears, at least in the record that I've seen, there's no evidence that the government, I would think, would have to drop the case because they don't appear to have any evidence that they could satisfy that. But theoretically, I guess he could be retried if it was that type of narrow ruling. But it certainly would not close the door on all the other cases that fall in within this ambit. Hmm.
All right. Predictions. Mark, are you sticking with 8-1?
Well, I mean, I do agree with Lee that the chief is on Alito's side, but whether, you know, he likes to be part of the majority, so he might be able to find his way into. So I guess just to keep things interesting, I'll keep 8-1.
All right, Lee, are you that optimistic?
You know, I will preface this by saying I'm usually wrong every time I've made these decisions. But I think Mark is right that, you know, perhaps the chief finds himself in the majority so that he can write the majority opinion. I think I will stick with 7-2 and you know, we'll I think that's what I'll keep with my 7-2 chief and Alito in dissent.
Okay, great. Do either of you, before we turn to questions of the audience, do either of you have anything you'd like to say in wrapping up?
Well, I mean, it's to me, it's interesting that Justice Barrett, I mean, first of all, her intellect is incredible. And she, you know, I mean, contrary, obviously, there was all these attacks on her religion and everything. But I mean, if anything, she and Gorsuch, obviously, I think, are the most kind of libertarian members of the court. As Gorsuch, but I'm just obviously incredibly impressed with her. And of course, the other thing could be interesting about this is obviously Thomas parting ways with Alito, if that happens, and Thomas being a little, in some ways, more like Scalia on criminal law than certainly Alito is.
Yeah. Lee, anything further?
No, I'm surprised that oral argument has kind of change, I think, what everyone thought going into this case. I mean, the government wanted to bring this case. So it's surprising to me that, you know, we're going to have a split decision where two of the conservatives, or at least on the conservative wing, are in dissent. And I don't think before oral argument, you know, anyone really had that idea in mind.
Well, that feeds really well into our first audience question, which is from Howard Meyer, which is, why did the Justice Department pick this case as kind of the test case for 922G3? I think Sarah Harris was asked about this kind of an argument, right? There were other people who were convicted under this who may have been, you know, from the government's perspective, more attractive poster childs. But why Hamani?
You know, the cynic in me thinks that they were hoping to be able to bring in the Iranian connections, tie this into dangerousness, and kind of overlook the, well, we don't have a, you know, historical analog, but this is someone who's dangerous, certainly in light of what's happening kind of in the geopolitical world. But that's my only thought, is they, you know, they would try and bring those facts in, even though they're really not in the record, but somehow get around it.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing arose, it started where they searched his phone at an airport and whatever, and some correspondence with his brother at a university in Iran, but all of it did amount to a hill of beads. I guess it was all, you know, nothing to see there. And, you know, I mean, when you get into a court, it's not like, if this was public opinion, you could, you know, get away with where there's smoke, there's fire, but in a legal sense, there's just nothing there. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. So William Smith has a question that raises the Commonwealth of Massachusetts' hostility to Second Amendment rights in general, and you know, I think asked at the bottom line, do you think a time is coming where the Supreme Court is going to say that, you know, except in the most you know, serious cases like the you know, the serial killer example or the fugitive from justice example, you have to have an individualized determination of risk of violence before disarming someone? Do you think the court is going to take a case on that issue and decide in that way in the near future?
Well, I mean, it certainly could. And, you know, that is what the red flag laws say. And of course, I'm speaking for you in Texas, red flag laws, there's not enough support to put something like that through the legislature, let alone something that wouldn't have that individualized determination. So I don't think they'd be out of kilter with, you know, certainly much of public opinion. And if anything, I think it's interesting how, you know, as I said, that a lot of people who aren't necessarily conservatives at all have maybe seen the gun ownership has increased among minority groups that tend to be the spectrum in recent years. And so I think the politics of the gun issue aren't necessarily quite what they were in the past.
I think that that's right. And I would say, you know, eventually as the court takes more of these as applied challenges, they are going to have to kind of wade into that territory of, you know, finding an individualized termination of dangerousness. Justice Barrett, you know, in her famous dissent in Cantor versus Barr talks about this, which is why I think, you know, she kind of pushed back against Justice Alito. And I think the court should do that. They should determine, as the historical statutes did, on an individualized basis.
The next question asks about something we touched on a little bit, but you know, if let's say the person who's convicted of violating 922G3 has a prescription, say, for medical use of marijuana, does that affect the validity of the conviction as a statutory matter, and does it affect the Second Amendment analysis at all?
Well, if they have a prescription, then it's not unlawful use. Unless they're, well, you know, of course, there's people who after the prescription expires, they get it, you know, illegally.
I guess my question would, and this goes back to kind of the rehafe idea is, you know, it's still, you know, illegal under the federal, you know, laws. So, you know, technically, would there be an unlawful use if the federal government has said that this is an illegal or controlled substance, that your prescription doesn't supersede federal law? I think that would be the argument that I would make on the government side. But I certainly think that it's hard when you can't identify what that category is, and if that individual knows that it's truly unlawful. I mean, they have,
well, technically speaking, right, if you have a prescription left over from pain reliever or something in your medicine cabinet, as people do, and you get, you know, you feel a little bad one day and you decide to, mm-hmm. You don't want to go through trouble going to the doctor and you just take it, then technically you're, it is an unlawful use,
right?
Which speaks to the breadth of the statute. Mm-hmm.
Charles Nichols asked, what are the odds of this case being decided on vagueness grounds alone? Any chance of that?
I don't think so. I mean, vagueness grounds alone, I don't think so.
Well, in some ways, that would end up being broader than the baseline case we laid out, because Congress would then have to change the unlawful use thing if it was... Mm-hmm. A vague period, and not just as applied, but facially vague, Congress would have to come in. And I don't know if the court would want to put them on the spot to do that when the other route seems a bit narrower, to just say, at least as with respect to this level of marijuana use in this case, it doesn't meet the bar.
Yeah.
And the final question has to do with, you know, whether the court might side with Hamani on kind of an overbreadth theory. And I guess I kind of want to turn that into, so overbreadth is a First Amendment doctrine, right, that allows, you know, a plaintiff whose own speech can lawfully be restricted to come into court and say, well, this restriction that is restricting me constitutionally restricts other people unconstitutionally, and I'm raising their kind of First Amendment rights. Is that a doctrine that you think the court will ultimately extend to the Second Amendment context, and should they?
I'll let you start, Mark, and it's certainly something I'm thinking about.
Yeah, I'm a little reluctant because I kind of think the chilling effect isn't quite the same, because at least, like, I mean, people speak impulsively a lot, but I mean, if someone was worried about that, you know, I guess they could go get a declaratory judgment that their gun rights are not compromised or something. I just don't see it, the chilling effect being quite the same as in the First Amendment context.
Yeah, I think I am inclined to agree with that.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you both. It's a discussion has been really helpful. It's a really interesting case, and we'll look forward to seeing how it comes out.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you all on behalf of the Federalist Society for your valuable time and expertise today. And thank you to our audience for joining and participating. We also welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep your eye out on our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming virtual events. So thank you all. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.